Dasha Kelly, thank you for coming in. Just by way of introduction, you are or run Stillwaters Collective.
Yes.
Which teaches creative storytelling, thinking, writing in the schools throughout Milwaukee.
Yes.
And privately, right? Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk to you because it occurred to me that white folks in this town, Milwaukee, don't have the faintest idea what it's like to be a black person in this town. Mm-hmm. And it's a very different experience. And it's not a conversation that anybody seems to be very interested in having, but it seems to me to be one of the most vital conversations that we need to have, especially in light of the violence that went on last summer at State Fair. Mm-hmm. And even without that, just the day-to-day going on of how we go about our lives without recognizing that there are people of color living just hundreds of yards away from us, but we don't see them or interact with them or have anything to do with them.
Absolutely.
For the most part. And vice versa. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes both ways. But so did you grow up in Milwaukee?
I didn't.
So, but you've lived here.
Yeah, I've lived here. So I've been back home now. It's been probably 16, 17 years. So okay. A good chunk of time to really get a sense of the beautiful parts of the city and the parts that definitely could use a lot of work.
Yeah.
And coming back as a transplant, well, first of all, I have a really different background in the first place. I'm an Army brat.
Okay.
So just by virtue of having been in moving boxes in and out, you know, literally moved with my family around the world.
Right.
So just by virtue of that, you kind of forced to accept people as they are, and you're put in situations and environments where it's always someone new, it's always someone different from you,
right.
Always opinions and lifestyles that you're not familiar with, and you just have to figure out how to deal with it. So having that be one of a really huge aspect that has shaped me as a person, mm-hmm. I kind of come to it a little bit differently. So I came back to Milwaukee, like I said, about 15, 16 years ago, and I was really surprised at how staid the city is, regardless of color, regardless of what side of town you live mm-hmm. on. I've always described it to other people, Milwaukee is a huge, small town. It's a small town that's got a couple hundreds of thousands of people in it, right?
Right.
But outside of that, I was really surprised that the segregation, the list, I think we're still on the top five segregated cities in the country.
There are some studies that say it's number one.
We were number one for many, many years, and
right.
I think we may have slipped to three.
Okay.
But still, it's not the top of list that I'm excited that we're on. And the thing that surprises me is it's a self-appointed thing. When I first came back to the city, I was working with a couple of promoters, and we were putting together a series called First Fridays. And nationally, First Fridays, the basic format is it's an after-work event, largely with black professionals, and it goes to different venues. So there's an after-work networking component, and then it kind of melts into a party.
Mm-hmm.
So, but particularly in the 90s, First Fridays was huge in major cities across the country. Hindsight, I didn't think to ask how many Milwaukeeans knew about First Fridays. We just went head first and tried to make
just
it happen.
Jumped in. Sure.
And one of the months we had First Fridays at, it's a venue that it was something else then, like 5th and National.
Mm-hmm.
And passing out the flyers and talking to friends, and one of my guy friends was like, oh, we don't go past the bridge. What do you mean we don't go past the bridge? I was literally dumbfounded. I said,
right.
Did you hear about Juneteenth? We're allowed to go anywhere we want. I don't know if those papers got to. And I had to realize, as someone moving back to the city that wasn't familiar with the expectations and the way things, quote unquote, just are.
Right.
So within all of our various communities and from the black community, there has always been this expectation. One, we just don't go outside of this quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
And historically, for a lot of reasons, we weren't welcome. It wasn't safe, and it wasn't possibly necessary.
Right.
So here we now are in a whole different millennium. And there's still this understanding or this unspoken expectation that we don't go outside of the, you know, past these streets. And the same vice versa. We also don't see a lot of migration across city street lines with a lot of other communities. And as a city, it's something that we've just accepted as part of our personality.
Right.
So that was something that was really difficult to get used to. So that is background. So as a black woman and a black woman who has lived other places, I just personally have not subscribed to that. So when I cross those street lines, when I go into other communities, and the work that I do inserts me into conversation, inserts me into groups of people that may not have invited me there on their own.
Right.
And a lot of things happen. I get the age old, oh my goodness, she speaks so well, which is a longstanding joke with African American people.
Is it right?
And then secondly, it is really this, I'm able to recognize this sense of wonder on a couple of things. Yes, there are blacks in this city who have a completely different lifestyle, a different life experience, different expectations from what you see on the news, from what is portrayed on the 6 o'clock, you know, or 10 o'clock news. That's not everyone's story.
Right.
And the fact that we still expect this monolith, you know, whether there's one type of black person, there's one type of Latino, there is one type of, you know, white person for that matter.
Right.
And we don't have the conversations, we don't have the exchange among our communities and our neighborhoods as we should to know different.
Right. You mean not that exchange between the Hispanic neighborhood and the African American and the white, because there's no meeting place.
Right.
But it's not just geography. I mean, there aren't, what makes that wall between, why not go across the bridge? I mean, what creates that wall? Is it, I mean, I know I'm being naive here.
No, I don't think so.
But it's just a long history of you're over there and we're over here.
Mm-hmm.
And what prevents us from reaching across that line and sort of joining each other? What's the fear?
I was going to say, some of it is a matter of fear, because if this is something that you've been raised to believe or understand to be true,
right,
that if you go over to that side of town, you're going to get jumped on and robbed and beaten and this, that, and the other. Or if you go on that side of town, they're not going to serve you. Historically, there's a fear that's rooted in fact.
Right.
And then the other part, perception is people's reality. So if I have this perception that if I go to, and I'm just totally picking out a community, not picking on them,
mm-hmm.
but if I go to Whitefish Bay,
right,
they're going to watch me as I walk up and down the store aisles. And that happens today.
Right.
If I go over to Fox Point, I'm not going to feel comfortable. So
right.
I'm going to stay in the neighborhood where it makes sense. And don't get me wrong, as humans, we like to be where we're comfortable. So there's nothing wrong with
that. Like to be amongst our friends, yeah.
And I think what is a greater danger is not whether or not we're willing to cross those lines, but what happens, what are the negative things that happen that are still occurring when we do make those efforts? So I had an occasion, a woman was a part of, I forget the organization, but they do the number of restaurants get involved and people eat on a particular night.
Oh, right, yeah.
And the dine-in.
To raise money for Heartland.
Right.
Yeah.
So she was a volunteer. And she
dine
was
out for life.
Dine out for that's right.
Right.
So she was a volunteer at this restaurant, and she's greeting people as they come in. The restaurant removed her, asked her to not volunteer anymore. So you have this African American woman who's greeting your guest, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's presenting, and I'm sure that she was well dressed. I'm sure that she spoke the King's English.
Right.
I'm sure she was polite, but still a matter of perception. So there are still things happening in the city where people are fueled on antiquated assumptions about how white people behave, about how black people are going to conduct themselves,
right,
about what Latinos are looking for. Now, the thing about stereotypes, no matter what group you represent, some of those stereotypes happen.
They're true.
They're true.
That's how they get to be stereotypes.
But if that's all you're basing it on.
Right.
If you're going on one or two examples that you think you heard of secondhand,
right,
you're doing yourself a disservice.
Right.
But it's, and I think you said, how do you solve it and how do you move past it? It has to be a greater conversation. People have to be willing to have this discussion.
Well, that's the great mystery, is how is there resolution to it? Is there a way of resolving it? There must be, because there's a solution to every problem if you talk about it enough.
If you talk about it enough.
And get it in the open. But I do think that we don't want to talk about it.
We don't have to talk about it.
Sure, life goes on.
You know, there's no reason to talk about it. And I am guilty of this. When I have moments where I'm in Greenfield or I'm really on the south end of the city, I kind of look and I said, I've never seen these people.
Right.
And there's a profile. I can picture the Packer jersey and the denim jacket and, you know, the bangs. I have this profile of this woman who probably has no interest in ever speaking to me,
mm-hmm.
just because I'm black.
Right.
Now, that's an assumption that I'm making, and it's probably not fair to her either.
Yeah, because
so
you don't know.
We all bring this to the table, but if we don't have to talk about it, if we're not forced to at least admit these biases that we have,
right, These preconceptions.
And these preconceptions that we have. And then on top of that, if those assumptions and preconceptions in my mind are only proven when I hear stories about my friend who gets removed from volunteering because she's black.
Right.
Or you have the white person who sees what happens at State Fair without knowing all the facts of what actually happened at State Fair.
Right.
So then we feel that we're being, that we have validated these prejudices, and it's the nature of the beast, I'm afraid.
Right.
So can we eradicate it? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. This is not a way to get past it or move around it. But can we mitigate it? Yes. Can we make it better? Yes.
Right.
And it's a personal choice. And there'll be some people who will choose to stay comfortable where they are.
That's part of it. I mean, we talked back in the 60s and the 70s about becoming colorblind. But in a way, it's like that was the wrong tact. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't be colorblind. You can't ignore it because mm-hmm. it is there. Because as you say, it won't ever go away. That there are differences, but if we talk about it and open the conversation up and find out where the sameness is, mm-hmm. and how can I enjoy the diversity of a different culture?
Right. When you talk about going to the 60s, going about when this conversation really first became prominently public, a lot of it was being able to lead by example. I think that's where we are right now. So the other thing that reinforces living on assumption instead of living on actual experiences,
right.
we have to see it in the people that we admire. We have to see the kind of effort in the people that surround us. So if it's your pastor, if it's the mayor, if the place that you work doesn't value, and not just because you throw up a picture of Dr. King on King's Day, and not just because you have, you know, a special menu during, you know, Hispanic Heritage Month. I mean, really genuinely make an effort to make sure we're showcasing the best of all that we have, people
right.
that are disabled, women. And a lot of times diversity, or at this point diversity, sometimes become something that you just check on a list as opposed to something that you have really invested an interest in.
Right, really involved.
So I think on a personal level, people are, they're inspired by the leaders that they have. They're inspired by the environments they live in.
Right.
And here in the city, it's so easy to stick to status quo. It's so easy to go through the motions of making the effort, of looking like you're making the effort.
Right.
And as a voting block, as parents of schools, as, you know, citizens, we accept it.
You accept it, and it's easy, except as economic pressures get greater and African-American unemployment is, I don't know.
Unacceptable.
Totally unacceptable. I mean, and way beyond white unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
Incarceration, African-Americans, way beyond. All the statistics lead me to think that there is anger. It may be okay, and you can go about your life, but there's anger building up. And the last summer is maybe an emblematic, whatever it is that happened last summer, is emblematic of that anger between the two. That
absolutely. I mean, the problems that we have are systematic.
Right.
When you look at, you know, African Americans make up what, maybe a third of the population, and we're 50% of incarcerated rate. There are not more of us committing crimes,
right.
but the environments that we live in have been targeted to have more. You can get less time for killing somebody than you can for having, you know, being caught with drugs,
right.
which is irrational and doesn't make sense, but it definitely keeps our community under lock and key. So there are things that, you know, the grades, the scores that happen in our third and fourth grade classes, that's how they determine how many prison beds they're going to plan for 20 years from now. So there are things that are happening on a government level, corporate level, that are by design already putting communities that, and at this point, not even about race anymore, it's class.
Right.
So putting communities that are not affluent, that don't have the resources to create additional options for themselves, limit the options to things that don't always make global sense.
Right.
So you get these young people that grow up and they have a reason to be angry. You get, you know, communities of color that, and they have a reason on a lot of levels to isolate themselves. It's
right.
not healthy. It's not going to let that community be as robust as it possibly can
right.
be. But when we have things in place where it's difficult to find a job, where it's impossible to make sure that your children are educated as best as they possibly can,
right.
it makes you create this environment that you're always in survival mode. And anybody and everybody who lives has had a moment of their life where they were just surviving.
Right.
Right. And if you are constantly in that mode, it's exhausting.
Yeah, it's exhausting, and you're ready to bust. Mm-hmm. It's a huge conversation, and thank you very much for doing it. And the point that we'll have another conversation at some point about the where it becomes not racial but class, social class, economic class, because those two areas overlap someplace. Dasha, thanks for talking.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
Yeah.